is the final lecture in Principles of Professional Communication 1. I've titled it, So What Have I Learned Then? Which I suppose is a fairly big call. When we started this course back in March, for some of you, I introduced you to a series of models of communication with the aim of beginning an understanding of the complex processes of communication. Since then, the lectures have discussed a variety of aspects of that process and hopefully encouraged you to think a little more deeply about the multitude of instinct influences on this basic human, social and cultural process. The lectures have gone from an outline and a discussion of transaction and transmission models of communication through non-verbal communication, the process of writing, electronic communication, cross-cultural communication, and the thorny and controversial issue of censorship. The aim of the lecture series has been to introduce you to some of the complexities of these issues and to encourage you to think outside the square, as it were, when looking at these in the context of university life and beyond. The aim of this final lecture is not to revisit those earlier lectures in detail, but to pick up on some of the wider and common themes that were covered. I also want to encourage you to read a little further in preparation for the exam in order to give your essays a greater depth of understanding. Your participation in the workshops or tutorials has hopefully given you some of the practical skills in writing and speaking to enable you to express yourselves more clearly and effectively. And while I don't intend to tell you specifically the questions that the exam will cover, but merely to say that it will cover all of the topics that we've lectured on. But I'll return to the exam specifically a little later. So what were some of these issues that the courses raised, and how are they interrelated? The initial lecture looked at the variables of communication from the following points of view. If you have a look at slide 2, you've hopefully come to understand that that communication is a complex process that needs to be thought of from a variety of perspectives. We said that communication wasn't simply a matter of sending and receiving messages, but there were many influences on how those messages were sent and received. And some of those included or related to the nature of the receiver or the audience or the decoder, to use those technical sorts of terms, were related to the nature of the person receiving the message or encoding, to use the Shannon and Weaver labels. They were related to the nature of the message itself, and the context in or situation in which the message was sent or received, as well as the channel or the medium of communication which was used. Communication was variously seen in different ways. It was seen as a transmission of information from the sender to the receiver through a chosen medium or channel. And we initially explored the model drawn up by Shannon and Weaver, who saw communication or who hypothesised communication as a linear transmission of information. If you remember Shannon and Weaver, the discussion we have had of them, they were theorists who studied telephonic communication and the range of issues that related to its success or failure. They were first ones to take into account the concept of noise, and the first ones to try and map the process. They saw noise as something that distorted the communication process and identified that noise could be semantic, i.e. related to the way words were used or the understanding of words. It could be mechanical, i.e. related to the way that the message was sent. So, you know, if your phone line drops out or if you experience static or a bad internet connection, and also that it could be psychological, so related to the motives, to the attitudes of the person sending or receiving the message. And they discussed, or they hypothesized, the way that these aspects impacted on the clear transmission of the message. What this model does is imply that communication is a linear process. That is, that it can be understood as a, you know, something that simply goes from one person and back again. Now, this is a very common way of thinking about communication. And if we think of particular ways of talking about communication, it these ways reflect that mode of thought, if you like. So if we say to somebody, am I getting through to you? Which we often, you know, say to children or whatever. I think he's getting the message at last. Now, those things imply that the message is going from me to you and hopefully in a straight line, and that if there's no interference, you will be able to interpret it. Now, another of the transmission models of communication that we looked at was that of David Berlow. Now, the difference essentially between what Berlow did in 1960 is compared to what Shannon and Weaver had done in 1949 is that his model humanised this approach. And it attempted to show what is happening in human communication as opposed to electronic communication. It used more human terms. Berlow also identified many more variables of the process, and so he broke the source and the receiver up into aspects of their communication skills, their culture, their attitudes, and so on. His theme was that any false move in any element of the process will cause miscommunication, and he emphasised the need for the sender to be purposive, i.e. to be in control of the process, to be aware of the elements and the characteristics of the receiver. The emphasis of this approach is therefore still mainly on the message and the various elements, and he actually broke the message down into a variety of elements, which we discussed in the first lecture, including the content, the elements, the treatment, the code, and the structure. And he also placed importance on the channel and identifying the characteristics of the channel which might influence how a message proceeded in its transmission. Now, the strength of this theory is that it enables us to see how a variation of any of these elements, such as a garbled message, an inappropriate channel, an unreliable witness, for example, can damage the veracity or the clarity of the message and the relationship upon which this message depends. The weakness of the theory is it still deals inadequately with the concept of meaning. It still assumes that the meaning lies within the message, as opposed to the meaning being also partially related to the characteristic of the person sending or receiving it. These models also imply that if you follow the rules adequately, the communication will by necessity come out okay. However, as I tried to point out when discussing the variable elements of communication, such as perception, such as language, and as Ray discussed when talking about cross-cultural communication, much of the meaning we derive in situations comes from our individual perceptions and experiences. Our knowledge, our use and experience with language, as well as the social, cultural, religious, and economic context in which the communication occurs. Now, another way of looking at the at communication we examined was what is referred to as communication as a transaction or a meaning-oriented model. This approach looks at communication in a more holistic way, as a more holistic occurrence, rather than as a process. Good communication, of course, does not necessarily mean agreement or consensus, but rather a shared understanding of the facts or the points of view or perspectives. If we look at slide 5, for example, the meaning-oriented model or transaction model assumes that the meaning, or recognises rather than assumes, that the meaning that we derive is in individuals, is dependent quite often on particular contexts or situations, and really can be characterised by shared experiences and common language rather than by one person interpreting or decoding what the sender of the message actually sent. In the diagram, which comes from the Moen McGregor textbook, the reference is on meaningful messages, on shared experience, and on mutual awareness. An example of this could perhaps be from the First Gulf War, which can be said to have occurred perhaps because neither the Americans nor the Iraqi governments realised the perspective of the other over the issue of Kuwait. Now, you can remember that the Americans went to war because the Iraqis, Saddam Hussein, had invaded Kuwait. The Americans, for example, did not realise how serious Saddam Hussein was about annexing Kuwait, and the Iraqis, in turn, failed to realise that the Americans would not be prepared to allow the balance of Middle Eastern power to move so far in Iraq's favour. The transaction theory of communication therefore does not see communication as flowing necessarily in a linear way from a sender to receiver and back again, but rather as two parties responding to a phenomenon or to the environment and each other, and bringing to bear upon it a set of receptors, if you like, by which they interpret the meaning. Therefore, a particular action or word in one environment may have a totally different meaning when used in another environment, in another situation, or by another person. Therefore, if we consider the differences between the transmission and the transaction models can be seen to take a more holistic approach. As I said, they see communication, I'm looking at slide 6 here, as the result of an interaction between a range of elements. They focus more in trying to understand communication on context, on situation, and on environmental factors that influence the evolution or the development of meaning. They don't see meaning as being fixed, but as being negotiated, i.e. we work out together what we mean, rather than I mean one thing, therefore you must literally interpret it, otherwise you're not understanding me. And they see meaning as an evolution, not necessarily a process. Okay, we also, throughout the series of lectures, looked at other factors that influence meaning. Okay, we saw that when we looked at perception, we saw that perception influences and refers to the way our brains select, organise and interpret information. And so therefore, as a result, everyone's perceptions or frame of reference or notion of reality is potentially unique. The point made was that perceptions are influenced by an individual's culture, by their learning, by their experience, by their age, and maybe their mental development, by their attitudes and their motivations and personality, as well as the context in which the communication occurs. Now, if we look, for example, at the illustration which comes from a very old textbook by Avery and Baker, called Psychology at Work, the caption says it's more difficult to read the word at the top than the word underneath. And the reason for that is that the arrows conflict with the meaning of the word. So it's sort of, it becomes, you know, difficult to do that. Throughout the lecture series, we also saw the way that culture affected perceptions of non-verbal communication, of language, and so on. Our lectures on both nonverbal communication and on the process of writing and language was based on many of the assumptions above. The emphasis in both of those lectures was on the recognition of the individual as well as the social and cultural nature of the tools that people use to communicate. Nonverbal communication was a particular example of this and could be seen as an example of how we negotiate meanings from situations. We use nonverbal messages to regulate our verbal messages. In other words, turn-taking, hand gestures, etc. to complement verbal messages. So, example, jabbing the air with your fingers when we speak, nodding, smiling when people are speaking to us. To substitute actions for words, so facial expressions of anger or disgust, which are used in the place of words, and sometimes to contradict what we are saying, so the use of sarcasm, so that a particular choice of a word or added to a tone of voice. One reason that speaking is often considered more effective as a mode of communication is that the absence of nonverbal cues to enrich our meaning is not available, and this can leave us insecure with an incomplete understanding of the message. The body itself is a message. Culturally, we have constructed a whole code of meanings related to bodily size and to dimensions. So tall men, for example, are usually considered to have more authority. You only have to read women's magazines or look at the headlines anyway to know that thin is favoured over fat. Fair, like blondes, are favoured over dark. Young is favoured over old. Big-chested over flat-chested for women particularly. Maybe Pamela Anderson and Demi Moore have gone some way to reversing this. Advertising is built on ideal images of male and female bodies and ideal images of food, clothing, cosmetics, etc. And these images, people make their livings out of these assumptions. The advertising industry is built on these assumptions. And we have to realise that, like many assumptions that we take for granted, that these images and the meanings that are attributed to these images are historically, socially and culturally conditioned. And so in some cultures, for example, big women are favoured over thin ones, as was the case in, you know, the 17th and the 18th century, if you look at some of the famous paintings of that time. Buxom women were those who were favoured as subjects of painters like Rembrandt. We also said in the lecture that nonverbal cues need to be interpreted in clusters and in context. I mentioned culture and that nonverbal communication includes a range of things, not just gestures, but the use of space, time, dress, and so on. Another theme which the course sought to explore was the idea that language is not just some kind of one-dimensional, static, neutral medium over which the writer or the speaker has total control. When we discussed the idea of meanings being in people, not in words, as well as the importance of non-discriminatory language, we also saw that words not only don't always mean the same to everyone, but they are powerful tools to impose power and to manipulate perceptions. We asked the question about the way in which language seeks to control communication. So, in other words, does language create reality or does reality create language? Why don't words mean the same to everyone? In terms of looking at writing as a form of language communication, is writing becoming outmoded? in the age of new media? What's the relationship between writing and the visual act of reading? And in terms of the argument over gender neutral or language or political correctness, is this merely an overreaction by feminists? The thorny and controversial issue of censorship asks a variety of questions. Okay, and let's have a look at slide 10 and remind ourselves of what those questions were. When we looked at censorship, we asked, whose interests does it serve? The communities? Well, that's the assumption. The governments? That of business, perhaps? What is it that we censor as a society? Again, I said that we tend to automatically think about images in film or themes, but I pointed out that we also censor a whole range of other things, including language, news, ideas, music, lyrics, video games, etc. The tendency is more to be concerned about visual images these days rather than written ones, compared to historically, what was written in books and things was considered to be very, very important and very powerful. And I asked the question about who the censors were and what were their motives. Were they political, moral, economic, altruistic? Who were these people? You know, who actually gets these jobs to sit down and watch films or to read books and make the decisions? Who elects them? Who appoints them? And why are they appointed? And we do need to remember that they are often political appointments made by people who wish to have their own perspective carried on through the act of censorship. The question, I guess, ultimately is that who has the right to make judgments in the public interest? And how do we judge what the public interest is? We looked at, or we questioned the, raised the point about editing as a form of censorship. And a lot of the debate over media ownership does tend to ignore the fact that, you know, a too narrow a group of a control of media can in some ways be a form of censorship, because what is considered newsworthy will radically vary. There's a much more limited scope for the presentation of information via news. Do people with particular viewpoints or moral positions have the right to decide what adults in a democratic society are able to see or to do or to watch or to listen to or to read? The assumption is that seeing influences doing, that because we see it, we're automatically going to, you know, carry out the act. Are there other factors involved? And I'd like you to ask that question of yourself, or to question that. And is it too easy, ultimately, to blame things like video games, music lyrics, for the wider ills of society? And I raised the question that, pointed to the question that Michael Moore made in Bowling for Columbine, when he talked to Marilyn Manson, for example. We also looked at this topic from the perspective of new communication technologies, and then from the perspective of ethics. And I believe it's very important to at least consider these perspectives. Much of our communication and our ability to use it effectively, of course, rests on an understanding and an appreciation of the social and cultural and interpersonal context in which communication takes place. Now, this theme underpinned the lecture on cross-cultural communication that Ray Archie did. And some of the questions that were asked there were, what ways does culture influence our ways of seeing? Different theoretical positions were introduced to you, the differences between high context and low context cultures. So that was Edward Hall's research. And how does culture influence the way that language is used? Again, there are various, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, for example, is one that I introduced you to. Other questions include, what do differences in nonverbal behaviour say about how a culture interprets the world? The theme, we must appreciate that not all cultures have the same values, attitudes, beliefs, same ways of thinking about things as do Western capitalistic cultures. The pervasive nature of Western culture in English language has led us to forget that our way of thinking is not the only way of thinking, and not necessarily the right, in inverted commas, way of thinking. I gave the example when we talked about in nonverbal communication of the use of different greeting gestures and rituals among cultures. And not all cultures, for example, think of a firm handshake, looking someone directly in the eye as being the sign of honesty and integrity that we do here in Australia. As was said, our culture, Western culture, particularly Australian culture, English culture, is very much based on or revolves around the importance of writing and reading, while many cultures, such as various Indigenous cultures, are oral, and this impacts quite different use of language. One which can be seen by Westerners as, you know, beating around the bush. We needed to ask ourselves, what do differences in nonverbal cultures or nonverbal communication say about how a culture interprets the world? Remember, we talked about the issue of time, the issue of space. And importantly, what strategies can we adopt to ensure that we are culturally sensitive when we are communicating? Finally, we began to explore the impact of various communication technologies on our lives, both in business and in private life. Some of the questions asked include, how do various communication technologies work? Do they merely give us another way to communicate, or do they alter the way in which we communicate? How do electronic communication forms impact on interpersonal relationships? Does it make us communicate more, or give us new ways to avoid people? Now, we talked about the idea of social presence. We talked about the idea of data smog and information overload. Those ideas are important. How do the new technologies alter notions of privacy and of public and private space? So we tend to assume that email, for example, is a private medium, but as I said in that lecture, that is not necessarily so. Your email is public. Your email can and is monitored, so therefore what you say in that space may potentially, you may ultimately be held liable for what you say, if it is libelous or slanderous or whatever. And what are the implications for productivity for organisations of information overload or data smog? And are computers ultimately, because they use different forms of mental processing, because language needs to, and information is presented differently, are we in danger of dumbing down our education system? Are computers hazardous to literacy, as has been suggested by some theorists? Finally, the exam. I hear you ask. All right, now, the information is up there for you to read. We put it up on the web. Roughly, the exam is 2 hours in length. You're given 10 minutes reading time. This year, we've allocated roughly 10 marks, or roughly we have allocated 10 marks to a case study. The importance is that the case study will highlight particular aspects of a communication problem and ask you to discuss them. A good answer will identify the aspects in terms of some of the theories that we've talked about, and to be able to, in an informed and intelligent way, discuss these. In the second section, and you must do all of these sections, there are three short essays, each worth 5 marks. You must answer all of the questions. You'll be able to answer them on the paper, and each question will expect you to briefly discuss the topic, outline the themes, identify the themes, etc. Now, these are topics that may be from any of the areas covered in the lecture. The last part of the exam is a long essay. You have a choice of three, and the three are from the major topic areas, which include censorship, cross-cultural communication, electronic communication. A good answer will engage with the question, show an understanding of the themes raised in lectures and workshops, and be more than merely anecdotal personal opinion. You should refer to some of the readings. You should refer to some of the theories that have been discussed. If you do, you can take your textbook and your reader into the exam and a dictionary, but no loose papers, no lecture notes, for example. And if you make reference to any information within these books, you must correctly cite the quotations or the paraphrases. Otherwise, essentially, you are plagiarising. Okay. The books that you can bring in, as I said, are limited. The only books that you can bring in are those that are listed there. You'll be asked to leave them outside otherwise. You can't bring in lecture notes, loose papers, other textbooks, mobile phones, electronic dictionaries. Okay. Thank you for your attention. I hope you've enjoyed the course. Best of luck in the exam, and I hope you can use this information elsewhere throughout the rest of your degree. Best of luck.